This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're done with your Oreo?
Yeah, done with my Oreo.
Okay, good.
Do you really know what happened?
The brother did.
The brother, that's what I thought too!
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah.
I mean, that's murdery thingy.
Happy Thursday.
It's okay. So, yeah, we kind of took yesterday to, it's like a mental health day. That's how I'm going to describe that.
Yeah, it was not fun. But anyway, Here we are.
And we're still here.
And we're here.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for listening.
Yeah. You know, we just want to keep, like, talking about mysteries and different kinds of mysteries and, like, not put too much pressure on ourselves. So I took down the Patreon page today, so, and I think we're just going to focus on doing the pod well.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, me and Mario had this conversation and, like, I don't know, I really want to put more into it and more research.
Right.
We're juggling, we're playing with the option of every other week instead of weekly, but we don't know yet. So keep in touch, stay in touch.
Right. So, okay, so I was going to start it.
Yes. Cool. I'm so excited.
let's jump into it.
I'm so excited.
Okay, so this week I'm going to dive into this, like, really multifaceted and really, like, tragic in a way kind of mystery or, like, set of mysteries, right?
Oh, tragic. Okay.
Surrounding so-called Lyme disease, right? Also known as Borrelia burgdorferi. And we'll talk about why later on in kind of the second half of the story. But I'm actually going to start out talking a little bit about my main sources. And like you were talking, like, we wanted to start doing more research, too. And I felt like this is, like, such a big topic. I wanted to, like, do more research. So I read this government study that was mandated by Congress. The study was done in 2018. Mm. It was, like, 80 pages long or something. And then a bunch of appendices. And then I also read this, what's kind of what got me onto this topic was this really great, like, personal and really informative essay by Megan O'Rourke in The Atlantic, which is always great, of course. And then I listened to an audiobook of this book called Bitten by Chris Newby. So all three of those sources, they really, like, focused and talked a lot about the really horrendous and honestly, like, needlessly agonizing and wasteful experience of people who suffer from these tick-borne diseases, and in some cases, and related illnesses. So, yeah, you know, as always, like, we're focused on, like, people, right? Like, the humanist viewpoint, right? So just keep in mind, while I'm going to get into, like, some technical details, right, of disease and some, like, you know, more intriguing aspects of this, but it all comes back to, like, the patients, the families, the other people affected by what is honestly, like, a growing health crisis in America. And I didn't know that. Like, and the report really talks about that, how it's this, it's not, yeah, there's not enough, like, focus on it. So anyway, and those two authors that I mentioned, Megan O'Rourke and Chris Newby, they themselves were also sufferers of Lyme disease. Like, they're both writers, but they also, and their families, in some instances, also, like, dealing with these sort of things. So just talking from, like, their personal perspective and telling, like, their story, which is, like, crazy. Like, a lot of these stories. So of the people who were, like, suffering from, especially chronic Lyme disease, which we'll, like, get into. But that government report I mentioned, which is called Tick-Borne Disease Working Group 2018 Report to Congress, makes the point that tick-borne diseases should actually be, like, a huge topic in America, but it's not. Both in terms of, like, the awareness of it, and especially in some parts of the country, because people think of it as, like, oh, that's something that happens, like, in New England or in Minnesota or something, but it's not. Like, tick-borne diseases happen all over the country. And there's not funding commensurate with, like, the level of impact that these diseases have. I was trying to think of there was, like, a lot of numbers in the study that I didn't, like, write down, but it was, like, orders of magnitude, right? Like, they're spending hundreds of dollars per case on tick-borne diseases and thousands of dollars per case on cancer or HIV or, like, other, diabetes, yeah. Heart disease, like, other major killers. And there are, like, hundreds of thousands of people, apparently, who are probably infected with tick-borne diseases every year in America.
Wow.
And apparently, they're also severely underreported. Like, 90% of them don't get reported.
What?
Which, I guess, is part of the mystery, right? It's, like, who exactly is getting infected with tick-borne diseases and where and how?
How do they know that 90% aren't getting reported?
It's based on the ones that are reported, and then, I guess, rates of not reporting that they've established through research, and then, like, the presence that they know, because there have been some studies of ticks, but not enough. So it's a bit conjectural, but yeah, 300,000 to 400,000 those were the numbers that I was seeing a lot in my research, new cases per year. So yeah, anyway, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, like, on all that stuff, but I did want to mention that, you know, it's about the people, like, right off the bat. So anyway, let's take a little step back and explore, like, kind of the basic mystery surrounding, like, what is Lyme disease? Like, what exactly is it, right? Because people throw that term around all the time, but what does that mean exactly? Now, you may think that this isn't, like, really a mystery, because we do actually know the particular, like, bacterium that causes Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, which is this corkscrew-shaped kind of infectious bacterium called a spirochete.
That's weird.
Very, very disturbing. If you look at, like, pictures from a scanning electron microscope or something, it's very weird looking. But there's major controversy actually surrounding multiple things, but at least two big questions. How do you know if someone has Lyme disease, right? How do you diagnose it? And can Lyme disease be a chronic disease? Is chronic Lyme disease a thing?
Oh.
And that apparently is also very controversial in certain places.
I thought it was chronic.
Well, we'll get into that. So, let's start out, though, talking about how do you diagnose Lyme disease, right? This is really, like, one of the most mysterious aspects of it that really has, like, a harmful effect on people, right? Because it's so hard to diagnose, it makes it hard to treat, it makes it hard for you as a patient to get effective care. Because the doctors, like, don't really know what they're doing in terms of trying to diagnose Lyme disease or tick-borne diseases. So most people think of the diagnosis beginning with that hallmark bullseye rash, right? If you know anything about Lyme disease diagnosis, you know the bullseye rash. And that's expected to attend this infection. But per the working group report, quote, however, 20% of patients may not develop this specific rash, and sometimes the rash is not seen or recognized, close quote. Sometimes because the person has darker skin, sometimes because it just doesn't look like a bullseye, sometimes because there is no rash, but you still get infected, which also happens, apparently. It can be, like, all different combinations. No one knows. So you would think, okay, can't tell by the rash, lab testing, right? You can test the blood, you know, the lymph nodes, whatever. Except that that's really difficult when it comes to spirochetes, those corkscrew-shaped bacteria, because they essentially don't show up in the fluids, or not very much, or their presence isn't seen there, because they actually tend to... like drill into, you know, like flesh or whatever, you know, other substances, not the fluids.
That is so beyond me thinking in that scale. Like,
I know, right? It's weird. It is weird to think about that. But when you're talking about virology, well, or it's not a virus, but it's kind of that kind of thing, right? You have to think about it on a totally different plane, right? It's almost like, what's that book?
Microbiology.
Right. But you have to get that totally different perspective where, like, the inside of a human body is like a universe. You know, that's the scale of it. So, you know, for this bacterium, a cell is like a building. You know, it's like, how do I get in? It has to mask itself. It has all these different tricks.
What book is this?
The book I listened to was Bitten by Chris Newby.
Oh, I thought you were going to mention a book where the human body is a universe.
Oh, no. I was trying to think of that. Flatland, where it's about different perspectives and changing fundamentally your paradigm shifts.
Or there was a cartoon, I don't remember what it was called, but the main characters were like bacteria and they like lived in the body.
Oh, yeah.
It was a kid show.
Yeah, I don't remember what it's called either. So anyway, to get back to the write-up. So while the CDC, right, the Centers for Disease Control, and the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, recommend those kind of lab tests, right, serology is what it's called, to try to diagnose Lyme, they endorse those tests, this specific two-tier serological tests. That test has known limitations, which are quite severe, actually. And in some cases that I read about, doctors will wholesale dismiss the test. They'll do the tests, right, because that's what they're told to do. But then they'll just say, well, those tests don't matter because, well, it turns out the tests have a high rate both of false positives and of false negatives.
What?
In other words, the test may tell you that you have Lyme disease, but it's really just detecting the signs, the antibodies of another disease. Which is not B. Burgdorferi or Ferry or any of the other ones, right? So that'd be a false positive. Or it may detect, you know, it may not detect any antibodies because of B. Burgdorferi or Ferry's immune escaping magic tricks, right? Technical details I won't go into. So it would yield a false negative. So if you can't go on a physical sign, like a rash, or lab testing, right, that kind of like quantitative analysis, then how do you tell if someone has Lyme disease or doesn't have Lyme disease, right? Further complicating the picture is the fact that there are no answers. Questions, but no answers. Right? You know that by now, right?
Classic.
Further complicating the picture is the fact that Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases may co-infect a patient. What's called comorbidity, right? You may have B. burgdorferi, but you may also have Borrelia or all of these other diseases that I don't remember the name of right at this moment. some of which are spirochetes, which is terrible and disturbing, but kind of fun to say, right? Spirochete?
Yeah.
It's like it should be the name of your parakeet, but it's not. It's a horrible disease or set of kind of bacteria. So, yeah, the co-infection. So a person suffering with Lyme or related illness also may have wildly different symptoms. Like we talked about a little bit earlier, right? In the best case scenario, and what happens most of the time, actually, is we think you notice a rash or a tick, right? So you know, okay, I might have Lyme disease. You go to the doctor, you get diagnosed with Lyme disease just based on the rash and the symptoms. You get a series of antibiotics, doxycycline or whatever, and then you're fine, right, after like a few weeks or something. So this is the scenario that clinicians and public health officials like to tell about Lyme disease, right?
Okay,
it's easy to treat, it's an infection, we know how to deal with this, it's fine. The fact that, inexplicably, for somewhere on the order of like 20% of patients, this isn't what happens, that's just not really like properly acknowledged by some of these people.
That's dangerous, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. And again, this is, you know, part of what they were talking about in the report. So in those books and like everything else that I was reading about. So this is also where the controversy over whether chronic Lyme disease exists comes in, right? That this is kind of like, but these are the people, you know, who are kind of fighting over that, right? Because for some people, like Megan O'Rourke that I mentioned earlier, right, the Atlantic, the author who wrote the piece in The Atlantic, who may not have gotten treated for a tick-borne disease or illness at the time when the initial infection occurred, or even for some people who were treated, Lyme disease turns from, you know, the flu-like symptoms that most people get to the fairly common joint pain, arthritis that a lot of people experience, to a lot of other much more troubling and debilitating symptoms, neurological symptoms. Some patients have also reported extreme memory loss, inability to read, vertigo, chronic pain, severe depression. There are inflated instances of suicide, suicidality surrounding, you know, these infections and the issues surrounding everything else, right? Getting treatment, getting diagnosed, all of that. So when these patients seek help, many doctors, partly because of the guidelines that they've been given, dismiss their concerns as the aches of daily life, or suggest that they might be psychosomatic or tied to a primarily psychological issue, or that the patient may have fibromyalgia, which is very difficult to diagnose, or multiple sclerosis, which is also very difficult to diagnose. Multiple sclerosis is autoimmune disease. Some of these symptoms and autoimmune diseases, and whether chronic Lyme disease is in some sense an autoimmune disease, like this is part of the mystery,
like,
right?
We don't
as well. We don't know. Not enough basic research has been done. So that whole thing. So some doctors fixate on this notion that if they can't find evidence of this supposed bacterial infection, then it must be a viral infection. That's another thing that I kind of came up in my reading. And they'll refuse to prescribe antibiotics, right? You don't want to overprescribe antibiotics, which is good.
Yeah.
You don't. And that's something the medical community has been harping on for years now. But, you know, you also don't want to not prescribe it if it's necessary, right? In one case I read about, doctors refused to provide a patient suspected of having Lyme disease, the patient suspected he had Lyme disease, they refused to give him antibiotics until it was necessary for something else that happened, and then the symptoms he was experiencing went away in terms of like the neurological symptoms and other things that seemed to be associated with a tick bite. But though a regimen of antibiotics does seem to like pretty much always help, or at least usually help, It doesn't, in some patients, ever go away. It seems to be, in other words,
that's
this
scary.
Chronic Lyme disease. So other people, though, like I mentioned, like the Infectious Disease Society of America, IDSA, don't think chronic Lyme disease really exists. And they also push this highly dubious two-step lab test that I mentioned earlier as a diagnostic tool. Even though, as I have somewhere else in my write-up, it specifically was developed not as a diagnostic tool, but as a tool just to for tracking purposes. And it was also developed back in the 70s, when, you know, our testing methods and things were, like, a lot different. So it's just very weird that they keep going back to that somehow. So that perspective is opposed by people like the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, ILADS. And separately, there's a whole other controversy among those people who do agree that chronic Lyme disease exists about what to call it. For some reason.
Oh, okay.
That I couldn't really get that far into the weeds, I guess. So some people say chronic Lyme disease. Others say late stage Lyme disease. Other people say post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome.
What? That makes it sound like it's in your head.
Yeah. So, I mean, whatever you call it, though, you know, it's there is this growing consensus, right, that it does exist. Like you were saying, that there's a common notion that it does, that chronic Lyme disease exists, that it's a something that can happen when you get infected by these kind of things. But apparently that is kind of being really poorly communicated to doctors. There's, like I mentioned earlier, there's that kind of like definition of Lyme disease that's not supposed to be used for diagnostics, but it still is. And as if things weren't already complicated enough, there's also some mystery surrounding how much, and I mentioned this a little earlier, of the chronic Lyme patient's suffering is because of the infection itself or because of the immune response in certain individuals, where what your immune system is doing to try to fight off the infection, for example, can create an inflammatory response that can cause other issues, right?
Okay.
So when, you know, you see in chronic Lyme patients, as one often does, high incidence of, arthritis, which is essentially a kind of inflammation, or there's this other thing called Lyme carditis, which is can affect the heart and kill you.
What?
Where are these things coming from? What's the mechanism, right? We don't really know. But part of it may be what the body is doing to respond to the spirochetal infection. And then some things that the bacterium does itself to mask itself from the actual immune system of humans. So, yeah.
This is so bizarre.
So, every case of chronic Lyme, right, and the whole thing in and of itself is sort of a really confounding mystery, right? And I could talk about it all day, but go read my sources and you'll learn much more. But now I want to kind of turn to the second half of my story. So now that we've kind of talked about some of those, the cryptic, like nitty-gritty surrounding Lyme disease, let's talk about this other big mystery that I kind of just stumbled on, which I told you.
Oh, is this the surprise mystery?
This surprise mystery.
You were like, yeah, there's going to be a surprise mystery.
I know. You've been so excited. I've been stringing you along for several days about this. So I've mentioned Chris Newby's book Bitten a few times, right? So what I didn't mention is that there's a subtitle, Bitten: The Secret History of Lyme Disease and Biological Weapons.
No.
By Chris Newby. So there...
But it's so unpredictable. But that's why it's a good weapon, right?
Well, I'll talk about that a little bit. So,
I'm so confused.
Yeah, what I didn't realize when I started my research, or even reading that book, really, was that Chris's story wasn't only about her family experience, her experience with Lyme disease. It was also about the possibility that our current endemic levels of tick-borne disease in America might be the result of an American biological warfare program decades earlier gone wrong somehow.
No.
See, it seems far-fetched.
Like,
no, it does.
Like,
it does seem far-fetched. And I did not read about this in any of my other sources, but she has some pretty good sources.
I want to know.
So, you know, you notice how I've mentioned B. Bergdorferi a number of times, right?
That's the scientific name, right?
That's the scientific name. I've not been calling it Lyme disease. I've been calling it that partly because it's fun to say, but also partly because the reason it's called Bergdorferi is because it was discovered, and I'm doing air quotes.
By a fairy?
No, by a Swiss-born American scientist named Willy Bergdorfer. Bergdorfer.
Okay.
Bergdorfer, who in the 1970s supposedly discovered that it was that particular spirochetal bacterium that was causing these baffling illnesses, right, that people were seeing with the children around Lyme, Connecticut, which is how Lyme disease got its name.
Lyme, Connecticut.
I think it was like 1977 or something. There were like a dozen children or 20 children in these rural communities around Lyme, Connecticut, that were getting this weird disease, right? Flu-like symptoms, and then they'd get arthritis. But they're like 12, you know? So it's like, what's going on? When Willie saw this, he said, okay, and this was the story at the time, this is like something he had seen much earlier when he was a student studying tropical diseases back in Switzerland. Or maybe it was when he was on a trip to somewhere else. I can't remember. But anyway, he recognized it, right? Because this was his thing. Like, his wheelhouse was tick-borne diseases. So anyway, his discovery, he got a bunch of medals. He became famous. It was named after him. That's where the official story kind of ends, right? But let's fast forward to 2014, when Willie Bergdorfer was at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. And it was then that he made a confession. A deathbed confession, one might say.
Oh, shit.
And that was that the explosion of confounding chronic tick-borne diseases, according to him, were tied to his work for the American government's biological warfare program decades earlier in the 50s and 60s.
But I also want to know more about that. The fuck?
Reader, listen to Bitten by Chris Newby. She tells the whole story. What we do know is that this existed, right? We know that now, that there was an American biological weapons program back in the 50s, 60s and 70s, I think. And Willie Bergdorfer was involved in it as a veritable tick expert. This seems to be well established, I think. So he became essentially, in that period, the go-to person for certain covert programs seeking ways to infect a hostile population with an incapacitating, is what they said, agent through these ticks. Now you were mentioning earlier, okay, is this a good idea? Like, is this an effective weapon of war or not? In the end, no. But they explored that possibility for a long time to make sure.
I guess that was the question in the first place, right?
Exactly. They had a lot of questions. Can you control someone else's mind? That was a question.
God damn it.
Can you, like, project your consciousness into another place? Like, there are a lot of crazy kooks at the CIA over the years.
We should turn into the CIA podcast.
The Men Who Stare at Goats. Have you ever heard of that? There's that movie? Yeah.
Yes.
I know, right? Yeah, you definitely could have a whole podcast about all the fucked up, crazy shit about the CIA. So anyway, Willie ran this covert entomological consulting business out of what was then the foremost repository, one of ticks in the whole world, research laboratory called Rocky Mountain Laboratory in Hamilton, Montana. And this work, you know, may have included trying to create specific co-infections or otherwise tweaking the various diseases and the ticks into which they were forcibly infected by people like Willie to create the perfect weapon of war for the Cold War. Because in the minds of these military planners, what they were thinking at the time is, okay, this, you could send it in, right, incapacitate the population without them even necessarily knowing what's happening. They just get these diseases and they don't even know.
That is so fucked up.
It is. It is. It's like sinister to the nth degree. It's like, crazy. Yeah, I know. Like, what the fuck?
Who's the capacity to even, like...
I know. I think that this was specifically in the military. I can't remember, but anyway. So, Willie seems, though, to have been sort of minimally, like, engaged with these sort of, like, moral implications, like, while he was involved in the work. It seems like he pretty much justified it to himself. There weren't too many options for his kind of work, right? In rural Montana,
right,
in the 60s.
Right, exactly.
And Willie was determined, and you might say, okay, well, he could go somewhere else, but Willie was determined to stay in Hamilton, Montana. He fell in love with Hamilton, Montana.
I hope that doesn't happen to us.
He called it God's country. I'll never call any country God's country, so. He also fell in love with one of the lab technicians at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory, a lady named Gertrude, who everyone called Dale. And they married, I think, about a year or two after he got there. And eventually Willie became a citizen. He wanted to, like I said, remain in Montana, remain in America, remain gainfully employed with his two kids. You know, he got to feed the kids. Willie made the necessary sacrifices in terms of time, personal integrity, to help develop this kind of perfect infecting agent, they hoped, transmitted through ticks, spent so many hours infecting and dissecting ticks, all this stuff. As time went on, the years passed, Willie retired in 1986 to assist his ailing wife. Many, many more years go by. It sort of starts to gnaw at him, it seems, on his conscience, what he did all those years later. And I'm sure seeing all of these tick-borne, you know, disease infections didn't help. Because, again, in his mind, he's partly responsible for this. So he also knew, again, according to him, that the official story that the government had told the public all the way back in the 70s was not the whole truth. Mm. Willie, according to his deathbed confession, didn't really discover B. Borchter Ferry at all. In fact, he recognized it as the same spirochetal bacterium that he had seen had essentially helped develop 20 years earlier at the Rocky Mountain Lab in Montana. Okay. And now he's seeing it in rural Connecticut. But he can't say anything, right? Because that would give away the conspiracy. That would give away the covert program, the bio, you know. So anyway, after 4 decades of keeping it in, Willie, I guess, wanted to lose his terrible secret, right? Lyme disease, especially chronic Lyme disease, may be an unintentional result of mishandling or bad practices when the biological weapons tests were done, some in America on the unsuspecting public without their consent.
So what? They poured some ticks into the forest and waited? Or how does that even work?
Excuse me. I'm trying to remember exactly. I think there were some tests that were done not necessarily with ticks, per se, but just with the infectious agents, like, you know, like released into the air, into a subway system. Now, at the time, they said these were all innocuous infecting agents, right? They're not intentionally infecting. They're not like Om Shinrikyo or something.
Yeah, I was
right?
going to say that.
I know that's immediately what came to your mind. But we've found out since that some of the supposedly innocuous infecting agents that they used may not have been so innocuous. So, yeah, there is that side to
but
it as well.
But it's just a deathbed confession.
Right. But isn't it intriguing? So, yeah, he claimed, and so the others, maybe even more disturbing possibility is that it wasn't actually the Americans doing it unintentionally, but it was the Soviets who reportedly engaged in a parallel development of biological weapons, right? One of these races they talk about, right? So one of them could have obtained the infecting agent, the tick, developed by the Americans and turned it back on the American people themselves. That's a possibility. Willie claimed that he didn't know which was true, but he assumed that it was one of those possibilities. He also did claim that the American biological weapons program had been infiltrated successfully by a Soviet spy.
What?
At some point. Allegedly. So, as usual, we're left with questions, not answers, right? A myriad of mysteries. Does our current national affliction with Lyme disease stem from the sins of our toying with biological warfare? Chloe, does it? Do you have an answer? No answer? Okay. How exactly should we define Lyme and related diseases? And most importantly, how can our country, the medical community, right, do better for the people? it's serious, don't laugh. Do better for the people dealing with Lyme disease and other related disease. I mean, it's just a tragedy that we haven't figured this shit out. Like, the story, read anything about this and you'll immediately you'll be enraged, like, because these people just have to go through so much bullshit. Dozens of doctors, thousands of dollars, hundreds of miles. Like, they have to fucking go through hoops because they live in the wrong place and they got bitten by a tick. Like, it's crazy. Anyway.
Always check for ticks, you guys.
And check for ticks. Yeah, it's
strip naked.
This has definitely made me a lot more wary of ticks and other stuff, like walking around. So anyway, my sources, like I said, Bitten by Chris Newby, the Megan O'Rourke article in The Atlantic, Tick-Borne Disease Working Group 2018, Report to Congress, Robert Hedaya at Psychology Today, and Wikipedia, the Willie Bergdorfer page. Willie Bergdorfer. So yeah, that was mine for this week.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to do with that.
Now let's...
Like, speaking of the Soviet Union,
what?
I am going to talk about the Amber Room.
Okay.
So, this is a pretty well-known mystery.
And I've
so
never heard as, of it.
Really?
No.
Oh, so it's one of the many World War II mysteries. And as I was looking into it, the timeline and the history of it all is kind of confusing simply because at this time it was a lot of he said, she said type of communication, you know what I mean? So, okay, let us begin. The Amber Room. This all begins in the 18th century, very beginning, 1701. It was...
right at the beginning of the century.
Yeah. So it was scheduled to be installed at Charlottenburg Palace. So this is when Prussia existed. So it belonged to the first king in Prussia, Frederick, and his wife, Stephanie Charlotte, wanted it built. And so, you know, they got all these people together, all these artisans, blacksmiths, architects. The concept and design was done by Andreas Schluter, and he is a master craftsman, along with master craftsman Gottfried Wolfram, and they also had people who specialized in the substance of amber, Ernst Schacht and Gottfried Turau. Should have looked those up, shouldn't I? And so this is construction goes between 1701 and 1709. In 1713, Frederick I dies. And his son, Frederick William, he takes over and he looks and he actually halts the project. He halts construction on the room and he stores the unfinished panels in Berlin. So it was eventually installed at Berlin City Palace, and one day in 1716, it was visited by Peter the Great of Russia, and our Frederick William, he gave the room as a gift to Peter. So this was like the beginning of the Russian-Prussian alliance versus like Sweden. So
cool.
The Amber Room was first a tool, a bargaining tool, and it ended up being that way.
Even a diplomatic pawn.
Right. It ended up being that way even after we think it disappeared. People were using it as a pawn. People meaning Moscow. And then I touch on that a little bit later as one of the theories. So at this time, it goes through many, many renovations. Eventually, it was covered. It covered 590 square feet. It was pretty big. With 13,000 pounds of amber.
What?
Yeah. So it was a wonder of the artistic world. And an eighth wonder of the world. It's practically priceless. So it has panels that are 999 pounds of amber, and there were gold leaf inscriptions on there, and gemstones, and all these beautiful mirrors and statues of children and angels, and it was beautiful, right?
Sweet baby angels.
So the modern estimates, like, there was one in 2007, and that one, the modern estimate for that was $142 million. And the estimate in 2016 was $500 million. So, cha-ching!
What?
Pricey. So, you know, it's beautiful, and, you know, it's being reworked again, and it's moved to Catherine Palace, where the Royal Russian family spends their summers. So it was officially finished in 1770, and it was used as also like a private meditation space. It was a reception room. It was a trophy room for even for Alexander II. He's a slut for amber, loves amber. Which is weird because amber is like just sap, kind of.
Yeah.
It's like you, resin, like
you
very
polish
old.
It up, you know.
Yeah, it's like millions of years old, though.
Yeah, yeah. It gets all, what's it called? Ossified.
Yeah. Is that the word? Calcified? No, that's calcified. Something totally different. I'm so sorry. We're moving on. Okay. Finished in 1770, lasts many, many years, hundreds of years, until 1933 when that motherfucker Hitler becomes chancellor
Man,
of Germany.
That motherfucker.
I just, anytime Hitler's mentioned anywhere, I just get angry.
Terrible.
By default.
Watching Glorious Bastards.
Oh, how satisfying.
Right.
So,
play
this
Wolfenstein.
Is when the whole, this is when World War II gets off.
Right.
You know.
Sure.
The beginnings, the roots.
The invasion of Poland, etc.
Right, right, right. So officially starts in 1939, right? And the Amber Room comes into place during Operation Barbarossa, which I think I'm saying right.
I think I've heard of that before. I don't know, maybe.
Barbarossa was, oh shit, he was like a, I don't remember who he was, but he was in like, I don't know, the 17th, 18th century. I think, no, it might have been earlier. I think he was Roman. I don't remember.
Hmm.
But
Operation Barbarossa.
Yes. Sunday, June 22nd, 1941. Hitler orders his troops, fucking Nazis, an invasion. And they opened up the Eastern Front. And so this was a pretty... The Eastern Front itself was huge, huge part of the war, right? And so, like, a part of their... I don't even know what this says. All part of their crazy plan. Okay. Get rid of my own hearing. So, yeah, it was. It was all part of this insane plan to take everything valuable from Russia. Take it all. I'm talking art, jewels, priceless artifacts, and really anything. And Hitler had like a whole group of like kleptomaniacs that like plundered seriously. And like there's eventually falls in the hand of someone else, and this guy like has a record of like 600 some stolen like art pieces from like the places they've, it's fucked up.
Jesus.
But you know, Hitler's whole idea of like erasing everything and starting with Germany, and
sure.
Like that's exactly what he wanted to do.
Well, that was the whole Third Reich idea, right?
Yeah.
It's like this
yeah.
is the Third Reich, like this is the one that'll last for 1,000 years and blah blah bullshit.
I'm gonna suck my dick. Okay. So yeah, the goal was to take over the Slavic people and, you know, make everyone German or something, whatever. Over the course of the operation, over 3 million personnel invaded the 1,800-mile front.
Wow.
Yeah. So this was a highly influential battle in World War II. It was one of the largest with the most casualties. 5 million Red Army troops captured people, and the Nazis deliberately killed about 3.3 million Soviet prisoner of wars. So they had, of course, concentration camps. They were put through death marches, starvation, torture. And although they, the operation ended up failing, the Soviet forces during the Battle of Moscow ended up pushing back the German troops. That's what happened.
Right.
So toward the beginning of the operation, the curators of the Amber Room were told to disassemble and remove it. But at that point, the amber had dried out and become, it was super brittle.
Ooh.
So they couldn't, yeah, they couldn't really move it. So, oh, what they did was they, so the curator, Anatoly Kuchumov, so him and his team basically covered it up with like wallpaper, like the entrance with like wallpaper and gauze, and tried to make it blend in, but obviously it didn't work because the Nazis busted it and took it.
Right.
It was immediately found by the Nazis. So, am I in the right place? Okay, yes. So, they find it, they have it obtained. So, the crews took 36 hours to take out the panels and dismantle the room.
Wow.
So it fit into crates, and then it was, like, put on a train, or there's some conflicting information of how many crates and if it was on a train or a boat, but it eventually got over there. And so it was now under the control of Alfred Rosenberg, and he's one of those people who's, like, huge klepto, crazy, sucking Hitler's dick. Sorry, I get so vulgar when I talk about it. I'm just sorry.
Inglourious Bastards. This is how they talk in that movie, so I think it's okay.
That's true. So the room continued to be moved around. It evacuated in Königsberg, which is now Kaliningrad, Germany, I believe.
Oh, I've heard of it, yeah.
Sure. October 14th, 1941. It eventually went on display in Königsberg Castle in April 1942. It was open to the public, and it was last seen sometime in 1943. So, like, a little more details on, like, last seen. It's kind of confusing exactly when, because we don't know, right? We don't know if it was bombed or if it was disassembled and taken out somewhere before then. But it was last seen sometime in 1943. So the bombs, right? There was lots and lots of bombing from the Soviets between 1941 and 1945, specifically in Königsberg. So April 28th, 1943, the Soviets dropped the largest bomb that they had, like the largest bomb in their possession, called the, okay, I don't know bombs. It's called either the Fab 5000 or the FAB 5000. I like Fab 5000. Thank you very much. It weighed 11 pounds and dropped it. Huge, huge, extremely destructive. August of 1944, more explosives were dropped. It was continuous. At that point, they estimated that 20% of, like, the industry buildings were taken out, and 41% of housing was destroyed. April 9th, 1945, Soviets finally occupy the city. They take it over. At this point, there's about 90% of the city is destroyed, and the rest of the Germans who are there are expelled. So, basically, after all of the bombing, that's where everything got lost. The Amber Room was, I mean, yeah, it was, like, never seen again, even to this day.
So it could have just been destroyed in the bombing that day.
That's one of the theories, right. June 1945, Soviet investigator Alexander Brusov concludes that the room was destroyed in the heavy bombing. But the Soviet Union doesn't officially abandon the search until 1979.
So presumably they know something.
Right, right. In 1992, Boris Yeltsin, the Russian president at the time... Did we talk about him?
Prime Minister? I think it'd be Prime Minister, maybe, probably. Anyway,
90s,
what, did we talk
Russia?
About him? Have we talked about him before?
Yeah, did he get poisoned?
Yeltsin? No. You're thinking of...
Boris Nemtsov.
Boris Nemtsov,
different,
yeah.
Boris, okay.
That was also at a different time.
Okay.
Okay.
And so he approves an agreement to have the German art that was stolen by the Red Army to return.
Uh-huh.
For them to go ahead and get that back. So funds start to be raised to make a replica of the Amber Room, and it was fully restored and open to the public in 2003. And so it still stands there today. The main theory as to what happened, there's a couple, I wrote down two main theories because there's many, many, many. So the one I kept coming across was a huge investigation by investigative journalists Catherine Scott Clark and Adrian Levy. They did a huge search into the room. So, and they put it all together in a book called The Untold Story of the Greatest Hoax of the 20th Century. So basically, it concludes that the room was destroyed, but it was destroyed by the Red Army, by the Soviets, not the Nazis. So they're saying that Moscow deliberately covered up what really happened because they were, like, too embarrassed, or they couldn't own up to the fact that, quote, Soviet soldiers had destroyed one of Russia's finest treasures, end quote.
Okay.
Wow. That's one of the theories. Mm-hmm. And that's based on documents from the Central State Archive of Literature and Arts. So there's documents there that also mention the curator, Kuchumov. He was sent to investigate what happened about, I think it was about 6 years later. So sometime in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s. So he looked at Königsberg Castle, where it last was, and he interviewed a man named Paul Feyerabend, who was a manager of a bar that used to be in the torture chamber of Königsberg's castle. So he interviewed him. He had a pretty great quote, and I have it here. A great quote. This is from an article in the Telegraph by Tom Parfit. Quote, "At the beginning of April 1945, the packed Amber Room stood in the Knights Hall. Several days later, the city's resistance began. I was located in the cloakroom and the Knights Hall during... I was located in the cloakroom and the Knights Hall during the attack. On the afternoon of April 9th, I hid in the wine cellar with several servants. Later, with their agreement, I hung from the northern wing of the castle a white flag as a sign of surrender. At 11:30 p.m. that night, a Russian colonel came. When I told him everything, gave statements, he ordered the evacuation of the castle. At 12:30 a.m. the next day, when I left, my restaurant was occupied by artillery regiments of the Red Army. The cellar and the Knights Hall were not damaged at all. However, after I came back from Elbing, where I had been in the hospital, I heard from the castle director that the Knights Hall and the restaurant had been burned down." End quote.
So you said they burned it down. Wow. Presumably not realizing what they were doing.
Right.
Jesus.
Yeah. So that also comes from the, like, oh, like, let's pretend it's still here because, like, ooh, it was destroyed. Yeah.
So that's why they would have kept up the pretense of looking at forward until 1979, you're saying? Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Others really do believe that it still exists. One of the more credible ones that I found were treasure hunters Leonard Bloom, Peter Lohr, and Gunter Eckhart. They examined reports that were compiled by Stasi. Stasi. It was basically the security police for Germany. Right? Germany?
Huh? The Stasi?
Yeah, it was like...
I think so, yeah. Okay. They were like the secret police part of the Nazis?
Yes. And... it was compiled by the Stasi and the KGB. So they looked through a lot of witness reports and
or
reports
was the Stasi
in general.
With the Russians?
It was, I'm pretty sure it was Germany.
Okay.
Because on Wikipedia it said like the German Republic of blah, 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 because Germany is actually called the German Republic of whatever. Okay, so yeah, we've got these treasure hunters here doing some research. And through the research they find the, quote, Prince's Cove, which is security for Germany in 1989. Does that say security? I think it says security. I'm so sorry.
What is it?
My note says security for Germany in 1989, but they heard about that and they, it's located outside a town close to the Czech border. So they went in with radars and shit and they found, quote, a very big, deep and long tunnel system. And we detected something that we think could be a booby trap, end quote. That's what Leonard Bloom said. So basically now they're like waiting for funding. Because they really think there's something there, but who knows?
Huh.
Really, the last theory was that it was straight up destroyed by the Soviets after the war.
Right.
They just took it out.
Hmm.
So is all that money missing? Who knows?
Who knows?
But my sources were Amber Room, the Wikipedia page for the Amber Room, and the Wikipedia page for the Battle of Konigsberg, and the Telegraph article by Tom Parfit, which I quoted from, and an article in The Independent.
Cool.
That's key.
That's super cool. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Go Team Mystery.
Yay, another week.
Another week is empty. Check a mark on the to-do list.
Right.
That's cute, right? I don't have weird shit in the news.
I think we can issue the weird shit in the news this week.
I've been less social media-ing lately because I'm addicted to a video game. But you know what? We need to go into that.
That's cool.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Yeah. Follow us on all the social medias. Instagram, Twitter. Facebook, Twitter.
Bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.